Well, welcome. Welcome one and all, and thank you for your patience in sticking with the Jivamiya Samadhi, this long teaching poem. Finally, we've reached the fourth talk, and I'll try to make my way through to the end of this long poem, the Jivamiya Samadhi, which, as you recall, because I think almost everyone's been here for at least one of the other talks, written by a famous monk in our tradition, Dongshan, and probably written around, you know, the 9th century or so. And if you've been following, like from the beginning over the past 3 weeks, you'll have seen that the Jivamiya Samadhi is pretty challenging in a number of ways. First of all, it's poetic form, and it's written originally in classical Chinese. So translators and we too have to kind of struggle to understand fully what this meaning is. And there's debate over what some of these lines may mean. So what I'm offering in during these talks is not certainly not definitive in any way. It's just my sense of what these mean. And of course, I've been reading other scholarly works about this poem as well to help me understand it too. I think the other thing that's kind of challenging is the imageries. The metaphors come from a time and place that are quite foreign to us as Western readers. So that's another challenge. And finally, perhaps the greatest challenge of all, is that the subject, the topic, what this poem is really trying to teach us is this suchness, thusness, kind of very, very profound Buddhist teaching, particularly a Mahayana Buddhist teaching, on the true nature of all things, and that this true nature is also our fundamental nature. When we are unrestrained by conditioning and unobscured by our kind of conceptual projections, and as I said the other time, also unobscured by our everyday lunacy, we too are suchness. And Dongshan chose as an image this jewel mirror to represent all of this. And it wasn't his invention, really. The jewel mirror appears in other teachings in the Buddhist tradition, because the mirror, as I said a few talks ago, you know, has this magical quality of reflecting back everything. Everything. It just reflects back. No judgments. Now, at the very end of my talk last week, I offered Dogen's advice, because I felt his advice on cultivating a joyful mind, a parental mind, and a magnanimous mind, are key ways to bring forward within each of us that kind of spacious awareness of suchness, and to help us bring it into our daily lives, manifest it, make it, actualize it in our daily lives. And in doing this, in cultivating these three minds that Dogen talks about in his book, Instructions to the Cook, I think then we bring forward our whole being, and we bring that into the world and share it with others. So let's dive back into the poem itself and continue on from where we left off last time. And I wish I had numbered these lines. It would be make it a lot easier. But roughly in the middle of the poem, and hopefully you have a printout copy, but if not, again, it's on the Mountain Rain website under Events.
Under this event.
Okay. So starting from where we left off last time, naturally real yet inconceivable. It is not within the province of delusion or enlightenment. With causal conditions, time and season, quiescently, it shines bright. So at this point of the poem, Dogen is bringing us back to some of the fundamental qualities of this suchness, this thusness, this Buddha nature that the poem is focused on. And he tells us, I think here, that suchness is not otherworldly, but it is flowing and pulsing, bright within what we understand as reality. And yet, of course, it lies beyond our ideas, our conceptions, our categories, beyond our kind of polarities of opposites, black and white, sorrow and joy, delusion and awakening. Everything enfolded within this idea of suchness, within this thusness. And throughout the ever-changing conditions of this universe, the suchness shines bright, illuminating all things in time and in space. The jeweled mirror, Dongshan tells us, shines through all our activities, whether we are aware of it or not. And then he continues with these descriptions or qualities of suchness. Next, he writes, "In its fineness, it fits into spacelessness. In its greatness, it is utterly beyond location. A hairbreadth's deviation will fail to accord with the proper attunement." Again, Dongshan presents these other aspects of suchness, and I think he's trying to push us, to go beyond our imagination even, or at least push our imagination to its very boundaries, to try open our hearts to this idea of suchness. Or maybe he's trying to prepare us or help us to let go of any conceptions, any subtle conceptions that we may harbor about this idea of suchness, about the jeweled mirror, samadhi. And this reminds me of a quote by Dogen, the Japanese monk who brought this form of practice from China to Japan in the 1200s. And this is a quote from the Genjo Koan, which is perhaps Dogen's most famous piece of writing, actualizing the fundamental point. And it's one, if you are at all familiar with Dogen, you'll have heard before many times. Quite a beautiful passage, I think. He wrote, "When you sail out in a boat to the middle of an ocean where no land is in sight and view the four directions, the ocean looks circular and does not look any other way. But the ocean is neither round nor square. Its features are infinite in variety. It is like a palace, it is like a jewel. It only looks circular as far as you can see at that time. All things are like this. Though there are as many features in the dusty world, and the world is beyond conditions, you see and understand only what your eye of practice can reach. You see and understand only what your eye of practice can reach." I find this passage quite humbling, and it helps me to let go of my own ideas. And consider, you know, the seemingly strange theories coming out of modern physics as an example, right? Quantum mechanics, supersymmetry, string theory, unified field theory, quantum entanglement. I have no idea what most of those are, by the way. Just things I've read about little bits here and there. But they all give us views of the universe that seem to fly in the face of common sense. And the little bit that I've read, they really kind of stagger the imagination. Dogen and I think Dongshan are both telling us, this is the way it is. It staggers the imagination. The world as it really is flies in the face of our common sense. So Dongshan tells us a hair's breadth deviation. And we're lost. Grabbing onto a fixed view, we are out of tune. We're no longer in alignment. Now, I don't think Dongshan is telling us there's anything wrong with having views. Fixed views, though, are partly or fully calcified, in a way. We hang on to them as if those views were the truth, and that they can blind us to deep appreciation of the moment, of things as they truly are. Our lives are no longer lived in tune with the reality surrounding us when we hang on to our views. I remember reading there was a famous physicist around the very early 1900s saying that everything in physics had pretty well been discovered. There's no reason to take up any more physics. Don't bother going to university to study physics. It was his advice to young budding scientists. So, let's continue then with the poem. And again, he's taking us a little deeper into these different aspects of suchness. But also bringing it, I think, closer to our own experience. So next passages here. Now, there are sudden and gradual in which teachings and approaches arise. Once basic approaches are distinguished, then there are guiding rules. But even though the basis is reached and the approach comprehended, true eternity still flows. Sudden and gradual. Well, theoretical explanations of sudden awakening and gradual cultivation leading to awakening started way back in India, not too long after the Buddha had died, but they became a really major issue in early medieval Chinese Buddhism, especially during the 7th century. One approach emphasized a breakthrough experience of the conditioned mind into a kind of sudden falling away. And the other explanation about practice and experience was actually that we really should take a gradual and constant polishing of our awareness and not emphasizing a kind of a breakthrough experience. So Dongshan in this poem, I think, kind of acknowledges these as possible understandings and that each approach has its methods that may be skillful, but he lends this passage with this line, true eternity still flows. And in this true eternity, there are no distinctions. He says, I think here, in the jewel mirror samadhi, in the way things really are, in suchness, there are no distinctions. Yes, moments of insights and awakening, and yes, constant practice, refining, integrating. It's all embraced. True eternity flows. So again, in this next part, making it again a little more personal. outwardly still while inwardly moving. Like a tethered colt, a trapped rat, the ancient sages pitied them and bestowed upon them the teachings. The image that comes to me when I read the first line is really settling down and taking up my zazen posture for the first sit of the day. Kind of holding the body still, beginning to bring my awareness to both my body and my breath. And I notice my mind is anything but still, inwardly moving. It is though the stillness of the body though, and the bringing of mind back to the sensation of breath, that gives me the opportunity to witness this inner moving, this inner trembling, to really meet the reality of my life at that moment, to really see all of the unsettling emotions that may be there, and all the thoughts that I really want to wiggle away from. Inwardly moving has also been translated as trembling. So in that translation, it gives a stronger sense, right? But the colt is tethered. The rat is trapped. It's in this little have a heart cage, right? Can't move very much. Sit still. The colt, tethered, can't run around the field. It has to just kind of stand there. It's in that place, body still, that we begin to see our mind and its workings. But the other image that also comes to my mind when I read this is kind of putting on the appearance of calm, but inside full of emotional turmoil. And isn't it true most of us come to our Zazen practice hoping to still our inner turmoil, whatever that may be for us? But when we sit down on the cushion, and I've heard this from so many people who, this is their first time sitting, they sit down on the cushion and they realize just how active their mind is. Zazen first shows us how truly we are. Zazen shows us our inner trembling rat, our inner nervous colt. We become aware. And then, as the poem goes on, the ancient sages, out of compassion, taught the way and ensured that the teachings were passed on to the next generation, that kind of warm hand to warm hand. These ancient sages discovered and passed on and following the breath, having visualizations, using mantras, all of the techniques, all of the ways we use to begin to help the mind settle. They taught us how to sit upright in a dignified posture, to be aware of body and breath, and rest in spacious, open awareness, and just witnessing the thoughts and feelings as they arise, avoiding entanglement, engaging in those, and gently letting them subside without judgment, and just again and again returning to presence, to this moment. I think that's the heart of what they bestowed upon us. And what a gift. Dongshan writes about us, perhaps. According to their delusions, they call black as white. When erroneous imaginations cease, the acquiescent mind realizes itself. If you want to conform to the ancient way, please observe the sages of former times. In the Heart Sutra that we chant at almost every service, there is that line, far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana. Inverted views is an expression of our delusion, our confusions, our calling black as white. And maybe our main or our major inverted view is our sense of having some kind of stable, unchanging essence, of also of being somehow completely separate from the world. We have this strong sense of separate self. Caught by our conditioning in this inverted view, we don't see the constant flowing of our inner being and our intimate kind of interconnectedness that we share with all beings and the world itself. So through our practice, and practice with a big P, including everything, Zazen, precepts, chanting, service, offering our efforts to others, through practice we actualize this jeweled mirror. We awaken to the suchness of things. Hongzhi, one of the great teachers in our Soto Zen tradition, he put it this way. It's so beautiful. He writes, "Silently dwell in the self. In true suchness, abandon conditioning. Open-minded and bright without defilement, simply penetrate and drop off everything. Today is not your first arrival here. Since the ancient home before the empty kalpa, clearly nothing has been obscured. Although you are inherently spirited and splendid, still you must go ahead and enact it." Did you know you are inherently spirited and splendid? But please go ahead and enact it. Let that shine forth. Let the suchness of your life shine forth. So he says, follow the teachings of the sages, the ancient way. So Dangchan next in this poem gives us an example of an ancient sage. And he writes, "When about to fulfill the way of Buddhahood, one gazed at a tree for 10 eons, like a battle-scarred tiger, like a horse with shanks gone gray." I love that image, right? Battle-scarred tiger, a horse with shanks gone gray. In the Lotus Sutra, one of the most, if not the most, important of the Mahayana Sutras, teachings in East Asia, there's the story of Mahavijñāna Bhikkhu. Bhikkhu, rather than Bhikkhu, sorry, Bhikkhu. And this is the name of a bodhisattva that appears in the Lotus Sutra, and apparently meditated facing a tree for 10 eons before awakening to complete Buddhahood. So a long, long time, right? Sitting there facing this damn tree for 10 eons. An old tiger, right, is likely to have scars and tattered ears, and an old horse, perhaps an old workhorse after years of work, perhaps having a gray or white legs and a gray or white muzzle. These marks, these scars and tattered ears and gray muzzles and legs, are marks of life experience. They are marks of struggle. Good images, I think, because after even a little practice, right, sitting on our cushion, we know how hard and challenging practice can be. Perhaps with these two images, Dongshan tells us that the journey to awakening is not easy. It's not a weekend project. It will take a toll on you. it will take a toll. You won't be able to watch all of your favorite TV shows, maybe. You may have to struggle with your emotions or some painful experience as you sit on the cushion and allow it to arise and cease. You may have to show up in your life, even at those moments when you most want to simply run away. It will take its toll. And yet, for those that engage in practice, there is a very noble quality. Like, I think, an old horse. And like, maybe, although I've never met one in person, a battle-scarred tiger. To me, this reflects a life well lived. A life that has also been lived for the benefit of others. Next line. Again, focusing on us. Because there is the common, there are jeweled pedestals, fine clothing. Because there is the startling different, there are house cat and cow. Well, lots of debate about what this might represent, I think. But I think Dongshan points out we all have different personalities. Some of us will be inspired, perhaps, by the display of jeweled pedestals, altars, brocade robes. Jeweled pedestals and the fine clothing could be anything, perhaps, also that aids you in your practice. A clean spare room, a black cushion, incense, sitting under a favorite tree, could all be, perhaps, those things. And while it's true, maybe those things aren't strictly necessary for practice, they offer support. And at times we all need support. Sometimes we need all the support we can possibly get. The phrase startling different, I think, may refer to those who are not enamored of jeweled pedestals and fine clothing. And Dongshan gives us an example, a very intriguing example, house cats and cows. Now, they are very relatively simple, everyday creatures that appear in many other Zen texts as examples of beings not burdened by excessive discrimination or self-centeredness. They're symbols or metaphors of beings resting in suchness, composed, present, at one with their surroundings, and largely free of a limiting view of self. Now, we have three house cats, and I may take issue with the fact that they lack self-centeredness. I think cats can have a pretty strong sense of self. But maybe it's just our cats. But anyway, that's what I think it's referring to. And certainly in the Zen texts, we see these animals as representing those qualities. Okay. Next line, coming close to the end here. Yi, with his archer's skill, could hit a target at 100 paces. But when arrow points meet head on, what has this to do with the power of skill? Delightful image, isn't it? In Chinese mythology, Yi was a very famous archer of remarkable skill. And two arrow points meeting head on. Well, that's an image perhaps where you may be familiar with, because it's also in another chant, that we do quite regularly, the harmony of difference and equality. And that line where the arrow points meet goes something like, phenomena exist, box and lid fit, principle responds, arrow points meet. Now, arrow points meeting in midair is miraculous. But the poem implies that this has nothing to do with skill. Rather, it is the natural, miraculous unfolding of things. Isn't everything miraculous? The beating of your heart. The way you unthinkingly get on your bicycle and take off. The opening of cherry blossoms in the spring. Your ability to see those cherry blossoms as they fall is the result of myriad arrow points meeting in midair. Moment after moment, they meet in mutual interdependence. I think arrow points meeting in midair is the dance of suchness. The reason we are here tonight is because arrow points meet. Far beyond our ability to comprehend this meeting of arrow points over and over and over again, we can simply look with awe at the world and the universe. The poem continues. When the wooden man begins to sing, the stone woman gets up dancing. It's not within reach of feeling or discrimination. How could it admit of consideration and thought? So the wooden man and stone woman appear in a number of places in Zen literature. And much could be said, but I think the essence of a wooden man is that a wooden man is a puppet, like a puppet, kind of free of discrimination, free of strong ego. And a stone woman is traditionally an image of a barren woman. But here and in other Zen texts, they flip it. And she and the wooden man both stand for the boundless, shining wonder of the Absolute, the great creativity that goes beyond what we can possibly conceive. Both stone woman and wooden man are images also of something that is very still, springing to life, giving voice. Something alchemical happens in our Zazen practice that is not in our control. We sit, and the very stillness of our practice is a source of action and creativity in our life. The very stillness, out of that very stillness arises, I think, the boundless field of suchness. During my first talk, I mentioned that Dongchan struggled with the phrase when he was a young monk, struggled with the phrase, insentient beings teach the Dharma. Well, a wooden man, stone woman, now he celebrates them, these insentient beings, I think. And through constant practice, we too begin to appreciate the Dharma of the wooden man, the stone woman, the tree outside our window. The paved pathway as we walk through the garden. And finally, the poem ends with this. Ministers serve their lords, children obey their parents. Not obeying is not filial, and not serving is not help, is no help. Practice secretly, working within like a fool, like an idiot. Just to continue in this way is called the host within the host. I should mention again, these lines also, how they're interpreted and then translated. There's quite a bit of discussion. But clearly the first two lines reflect Confucian values in China, especially the foundational value of filial piety. But another way to view this is the importance of giving help. What we do in serving others brings forward our connection with others, responding to suffering and distress wherever we see it is being filial. Finally, Dongshan stresses the importance of practice. He encourages us not to make a great show of our practice, but just do it, almost unnoticed, so that other people won't see that we do it with a kind of gentle humility. Fools and idiots are scorned by others, right? But in the Zen tradition, they can also be wise fools and wise idiots, like the very famous Japanese poet and monk Ryokan that both Kate and I have spoken about in the past. His name, Ryokan, basically translates as great fool.
Daigu.
Daigu. Oh, right, that's his first name. Thanks, Kate. See, here's another idiot. Not reaching and grabbing for goals and standards of current society, like the big house, fame, praise, blame, wealth. The fool and idiot celebrate the simple life of everyday practice and gratitude, like Ryokan did. And like a good host who takes care of the needs of her guests. The phrase host within a host emphasizes the giving, the compassionate nature that arises from suchness, the interbeing of all things, the jewel mirror. Taking care of all beings is like the great compassion bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, right? Host within the host. And that includes to take care of yourself. Dongshan does not ask for sacrifice in that way. Dongshan here asks for compassion. And sometimes compassion is towards the self. In fact, maybe it always is. We always must include that too. Nothing is outside. Nothing outside. Well, that's the end of the poem. Whew. Another one bites the dust. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, for your patience and going through this with me. I realized